Welcome to That 80s Show. Now, I'm not a person to sing along to a song, but if you cannot sing along to that, you need to be examined by a professional. Hello, Dori. How are you?
Oh, Paolo, that was so nostalgic.
That was good times. Four tops.
I love that song. I haven't heard it in so long.
You know we've never played it before.
Really?
Never played Loco and Acapulco. Listen, we're going to have a problem because this opening segment is about Acapulco. I can't say it.
I see the problem. I see the problem. Can we just quickly, before we move on to Acapulco, that song is from the Buster soundtrack, if I'm correct.
Oh, really?
Buster was the movie starring Phil Collins.
Yes, yes.
The true story about that that robber. He pulled off a very successful heist. I seem to remember the song being on that soundtrack because we had that soundtrack and we used to listen to it all the time when I was growing up.
You know, that makes sense because in compiling the playlist this week, there was a Phil Collins photo around that. I saw it. Yes. I was like, I didn't think too much about it. I was like, oh, okay. All right. It's all right. That does make a lot of sense. It's all wrapped up.
Well, Phil Collins just pops up unexpectedly most of the time.
So. All the time. All the time. So this is That 80s Show. And look, you're listening live right now, Cliff Central. Thank you for listening to the live version of it. You get the music as an added treat. But if you want to share the show with your friends on cliffcentral.com, all the podcasts, this episode plus all the previous episodes, plus our interviews with Thomas Anders and Gary Kemp and Joan Armatrading and all our 80s friends are on there. Our logo, our new logo for That 80 Show is a thing of beauty, Dori. I mean, that's amazing work by Aaron. And it really stands out. Shout out to Aaron,
as we call him in the office.
Aaron. I'm here all day for that. So if you hear something on the show you want to share, or you heard it, you go, what? I can't believe those two idiots said that. You can go find it. It's on cliffcentral.com, on the app and on the website. Now, there is a new show. I said, when Dori and I were talking about Red Oaks, I said it fits the criteria for me. It's set in the '80s and it's 30 minutes long. And that's pretty much my standards. I don't need much more to watch a show. And, Apple TV, they, had Physical, which was set in the '80s and about 30 minutes long. They follow it up with another TV show set in 1980s Mexico, but at a resort called Las Colinas. The TV show is called Acapulco, okay? I'm going to battle.
Oh, right? You did it. Well done.
Did I say it? Acapulco, right? And so that's why we play the four top song. Dori, I don't know if you've seen any of this. I got very excited. I told you about it. I think I showed you the trailer, and we'll put it up on That 80 Show SA Facebook page. It is so gloriously kitschy 80s, okay?
It's bright colors. It's like kind of harks back to Miami Vice vibes in a way.
Very much.
Hey,
it's
very like tropical setting.
This hotel, and it follows the story of the staff in the hotel. Quite funny. Very 80s. Like there's the 80s douchebag. There's all the 80s tropes are in there. It's so well done. The costumes, the hair, the drinks they have is so 80s, right?
Is it a little bit like Red Oaks meets Jane the Virgin?
So a lot of people are saying it's Jane the Virgin-ish. Yeah, a lot of people definitely say it's Jane.
I mean, I've only seen the trailer, but I got very strong Jane the Virgin vibes from the trailer.
Yeah, a lot of it's like Red Oaks went on holiday, went on spring break. That's what it's like. And Las Colinas, this resort that it's set in, is the pinkest pink I've ever seen. There is no way that's real paint, right? They've obviously, like, that's all CGI'd how pink that is. It's unreal. There is the foyer of the hotel is pink. Like, inside your body pink, right? Like, that's the pinkest pink. Like, you cut yourself open, the pink inside you, that's the pink. And
isn't it the same as 1980s Sun City pink?
Oh, no. This is like pink. I know that pink, right? Sun City is a resort in South Africa that was super popular and hedonistic in the 80s. And it was like pink. And pink. But I remember the Sun City pink, but this is like the Sun City pink looks faded compared to how pink Las Colinas is. Okay. And the entrance, the foyer, is got black and white checked tiles as far as the eye can see. It is phenomenal. And there's all these like little 80s things they bring in. Like there's, you know, the first time a kid finds a Rubik's Cube, and then there's that little game Simon. And so there's a lot of little things like that, right? So many cool touches in this. Each episode so far, it's three episodes in. Each episode so far is named after an 80s song, right?
I love that.
It's such a nice touch.
Do tell us the titles.
Jesse's Girl.
Nice.
Invisible Touch. Phil Collins. Keeping that link. Mm-hmm. And Crazy Little Thing Called Love. Okay, that's the episode so far.
Cool.
But the best part is, Dari, this is the best part. In a parallel universe, an alternate timeline, an alternate multiverse, these people are you and I, right? I've never seen more you and I than these two, right? Hispanic versions of us. There Amazing. Is there is a band, and if you watch the trailer, you'll see it. But they are my favorite. They pop up every now and again. They're the background characters so far. They're the Las Colinas Entertainers. That's the name of them. A guy and a girl who sing 80s songs. I've never heard 80s songs covered in Spanish, but now I can't live without them, okay?
I mean, you sent me a picture, and I see myself in that girl. I see it.
I'm telling you, Dari. I'm telling you. So, I mean, like, describe her, and I'll describe him.
So she has she's in this very dramatic, angsty pose. She's singing, so she's holding a microphone up to her mouth. That's where her and I very much differ. I cannot sing to save my life. She's holding a microphone up, and she's like doing that very dramatic hand up to forehead motion. She's wearing very bright colors, but she's also got like curlyish brown hair, which I have been known to have, especially in the 80s. I see myself. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
So many bangles. She's wearing these like green pants, and so is he. Yeah. He's wearing matching green, like flary pants.
I mean, they look like palm trees.
Yes.
Like very decorative palm trees.
He's super Rico Suave, right? And he's got this pink shirt, not only buttoned from the navel. There is only a button from the navel. There are no other buttons. This is how the shirt is, okay?
You can't see. He doesn't have any gold chains, right? But I mean, he looks like he should have gold chains.
No, he has gold chains. I mean, like, this is the one outfit. The outfits are spectacular. There's red pumps at one point. I mean, they are amazing. I love them. Las Colinas Entertainers. So I have to play you some of the songs. Now, I found the whole soundtrack, okay? Of course, it's Apple, so it's on Apple Music. You can get the whole soundtrack with all the songs by the Las Colinas Entertainers. But I'm only going to play you the three songs that have been in the show so far, okay? This is some glorious stuff. I'm going to drop the volume because I want you to be able to talk over it. It is so great. The first one is, this is in the trailer. This is the one that got me so excited. This is Las Colinas doing Vacation by the Go-Go's, but of course it's Vacacion. So that's the one that got my attention, right? That's Vacation Go-Go's. That's their Las Colinas, right? One of the episodes, there is a montage, a getting everyone ready montage. And if you're going to do a montage in the 80s, there's only one song that goes with it. It's Eye of the Tiger by Las Colinas or Ojo del Tigre.
Okay, well done. I think that's an impressive attempt at the language.
I should speak better because I speak Portuguese, so I should be able to do it. I'm giddy. Listen to this. The best, the highlight, the best of them was, the absolute best for me was, as so far, like I say, I watched this over and over again. This is the part where I said, this is you and I. You and I in an alternate universe, we end up in the 1980s as resort singers at a Mexican resort. We are Mexican. Okay.
Yes.
This is the one that got me where I was like, oh my God, that is Dari. You must see this woman's dance moves to the song. But it's like the scene is so, like, this is all the scenes with them why it's so funny because it's so throwaway. They're just there, but like they're so there that you can't help but like keep watching them. And it's this like swooping drone shot over the sea, over them performing this song. And they do this crazy little dance move. at the beginning of the song, but like the most 80s little, like, come show your aunties the dance that you're doing. You know, that sort of dance.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's that dance. This is my favorite so far.
He's just got a very high, girly voice.
And even in the Vacacion, all the falsetto, the harp, it was him. It wasn't her, it was him. And that's his thing. There's another one where they sing True by Spandau Ballet. Oh my God, that was so good. But this killed me.
I mean, if we were to sing together, Paolo, you would be the falsetto. Let's be honest.
I definitely would. I definitely would. And you would be belting out Come a Chameleon. That it ended me as a human being. I can't handle it. We don't know the characters' names yet. We haven't been, they sort of background. They don't really talk. There's one episode where they're involved and they don't want to do anything unless it's for money. But they kill me. I've seen the soundtrack. You say you want to get Apple TV. I think you can get like a free 2-week trial, but Apple are very clever in, they're very clever and they only do one episode a week. So in the beginning they do like three and then it's one a week. So they get you.
But then at the end, will they all be there?
They're all there.
Do they disappear?
No, they're all there.
So maybe you let me know when the series is finished and then I'll binge it.
Yes, that's a good thing to do. I think that's very clever because we don't support piracy and torrents VPNs. No, not at all. You must.
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, poor Apple. It's a struggling company. They've pivoted.
Support them.
Yes, they've pivoted to content because, you know, people aren't paying, you know, hundreds of dollars for like plugs. So we have to support them. If anything, you're paying for season two of the spin-off show, Las Colinas Entertainers, and it'll just be about them. It's glorious. You will find the soundtrack on Apple Music. It is there. Just look for the Las Colinas. They are the best. I'm so in love with them.
Awesome.
That is TV talk. Obviously, we're always talking TV, movies, everything we spoke about as much as we can. We'll put on that 80 Show essay Facebook page. Highlight of the week for me, Dory's obscure, crazy, or just a normal movie with Dory's wild take on it.
So speaking of outrageous, I again used the random movie generator to come up with this week's movie.
Now, if people
and
have
when
missed
this
that,
popped up.
Sorry, yeah. Dory, if people missed that before, this random movie generator, we found it a few weeks ago. Such a clever thing.
There's
you go
actually
in,
a bunch, by the way.
There's a bunch.
The
there's
one
bunch,
we found was just one of many.
Yes, there are
and
lots.
I actually used a different one last night, which seemed to work a little bit better than the one we spoke about.
Yeah, the one
I'll
we speak
honest,
about,
it actually,
it's not the best.
It actually gives you the results you ask for.
Yes, because what I found about the one that we used is that when you look for a crap movie, it doesn't give you crap movies. And I want rubbish.
Yeah. Well, so this one that I found last night, it's quite funny because you can select, there's a drop-down menu with genre, right? And you can select more than one. So I thought, oh, cool, this will make my life a lot easier because I don't know exactly what I'm looking for. Let me just select a bunch of things. But what it actually does is if you select, for example, what I did last night was I selected comedy, sci-fi, and I think romance or something. I selected three categories. It then only finds the movie that fits into all three categories.
Oh my
like
God.
It's not like it'll find movies that fit into all those categories.
Yes.
So I did comedy, sci-fi and romance and it only gave me one result, which was Weird Science.
Oh God, that is so good.
It was so funny. So I was like, okay, I need to go one genre at a time. So I was just going through different genres because I've decided because you are doing horror month for Halloween, I'm going to be the opposing force to that. And I want to do light, funny, silly, very much the opposite of horror this month is what I'm doing.
Nice.
To, you know, counteract you. So one of the things that came up, I was like, oh my goodness, I loved this film. There is a small chance I've spoken about it in the past, but if I did, it was very long ago. This was one of my favorite films. It was one of those, remember I told you that in my youth, we had a few things on VHS.
Yes.
That we did not return to the video store or recorded off TV. This was one of those movies that I somehow had a copy of and I used to watch it so many times. And it's so funny because it's really not actually my kind of movie, but when I was watching clips and like going through it again last night, I was like, oh, actually it really is great. And you know what? unlike so many movies that I choose for the show, this was a box office success. It was not a flop. It was not obscure. We are talking blockbuster here. I'm going to give you the cast and see if you can guess, because you might be able to. This movie stars Melanie Griffith.
Okay.
Harrison Ford. Sigourney Weaver. If you don't know it from those three, then you don't know it, because I don't know if they've ever been in anything else altogether. It's not a comedy.
Yes.
It is not a comedy. In fact, it's more of a drama, but it has very funny parts.
Yes.
I
know it.
I'm going to send you two pictures on WhatsApp quickly.
Okay.
Because before you guess, this movie has the most glorious hair and makeup. Glorious, glorious. In fact, there was an interview with, I went through YouTube last night, just finding everything I could about it, just to remind myself. And there was an interview with Sigourney Weaver that was actually done only a few years ago, where they were talking about it. And she was talking about how the hair and makeup were basically their own characters in this film.
they were.
I've just sent you two pictures.
There we go.
We will put these pictures on our Facebook page.
That top one, unfortunately, she is a Cusack, so I cannot support what's going on.
I know, and I thought, there's no way in hell you actually either have watched or know or like this movie, because it does star Joan Cusack. I did forget to mention her. It does star Joan Cusack. Her role is a bit smaller. And I was like, if you did watch this movie, this might be the one that put you off her for life, because her character is very over the top.
I remember her.
She is the comic relief, actually, in the movie.
Do you know how many times I am looking for an 80s gif for the show or to promote the show or something?
Yeah.
And that exact image, that scene, because she sneers afterwards, comes up. It's so popular.
Mm. Yeah.
She's super 80s. And exactly. Then the one below, who is that?
Is very popular.
Who is below that?
That is Melanie Griffith.
Is that her? My God. Plastic surgery.
That is Melanie.
Be damned. She actually has a human face.
Yeah, she's had a bit too much work done in the later years. But I mean, she was a beautiful woman. And I mean, she's really beautiful. I mean, the hair is something else. But halfway through the movie, she does get a decent haircut.
I don't think you've mentioned the name of the movie yet.
But do you know which movie it is?
I do know. Well, I do know what it is now. Sorry about that. I do know what it is now. That's my movie trailer.
Was that from your movie?
Yeah, it just popped in.
So I'm talking about the movie Working Girl.
Yes.
And this movie is actually probably most known for its theme song, which won so many awards.
I hated that song.
The director and the writer must have been so upset, because they were nominated for so many awards. They didn't win a single thing. Melanie Griffith and Sigourney Weaver did win a few awards. They won Golden Globes and stuff like that. The director and writer got nothing, but the song won everything. And it's a very screechy, over the top song by Carly Simon.
There was a stage. Say it again. Sorry, I jumped in on you there.
It's the song's by Carly Simon, who, I mean, I'm not a fan, I'll be honest.
There was a stage where that song was everywhere. We forget radio play. We actually do, because we don't listen to all that much, as much radio as we used to, right?
Yeah.
That song was, it's in the biz, it's called high rotation. It was hyper rotation, that song. And you then, there used to be, remember between TV shows, they used to play music videos as fillers?
Yes.
They'd play it there. Yes. There used to be chart shows about music. They played it there. That song was everywhere.
And it is very screechy. I mean, it's the only way to describe it. Because I was watching, as I said, I was watching clips on YouTube last night, and one of the clips is the opening sequence, which has that song playing.
Yeah.
And I actually had to turn the volume right down, because it was actually torture to listen to.
Agreed.
Really horrible. Anyway, let's get into the actual film, because we haven't even spoken about the storyline, which is really, it's been described as almost a Cinderella type story, because it really is cool. And it was it was making a bit of a feminist statement in its time. It came out in 1988. Mm-hmm. And it starts out with Melanie Griffith is a secretary, right? But, some people would call her an assistant. And, That actually comes up in the movie. One of the other women's like, I prefer to be called assistant. I think that's when it all started. And she's just got these horrible, horrible bosses, these male bosses. I mean, there's a scene with Kevin Spacey who makes like a cameo in the film. I mean, he does turn out to be a creep in real life, but in this movie, he is such a creep. They're in the back of a car, like a limo type, not really a limo, just a normal car. And he's snorting cocaine and he's just spilling champagne all over her. And she's like, this is supposed to be a business meeting. And he's like, no, we're going to go to the hotel. And he's just being such a creep. And it starts out with us to show like these horrible experiences she's had with these male bosses. And then she gets assigned to a female boss and she's like, oh, finally, someone who's going to understand me and who's going to be like, you know, the sisterhood and blah, blah, blah. And that is played by Sigourney Weaver, who is just a class A biatch completely. But in the beginning, you don't realize that because she seems to be all lovely and she seems to be like, oh yes, you know, tell me your ideas. You know, I think that as women, we've got to, you know, stick together in this industry. They work in mergers and acquisitions. Don't ask me what that is. Whatever. And
an 80s job.
And they take over other companies, whatever. Yes, whatever.
An 80s Wall Street job. Yeah.
And it was actually described in one of the clips as the female version of Wall Street, basically.
You know, this movie was huge. It really was a cultural touchstone type of movie. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And what happened was, when originally it came out, Mike Nichols wanted Melanie Griffith for the role, but she was very new. She hadn't done a lot at all. She wasn't a big star. And the studio, you know, the producers were like, no, that's not going to happen. And Mike Nichols was like, if she's not in it, I'm not directing it. And they really wanted him. So then they especially cast Harrison Ford and Sigourney Weaver, who were very big stars at the time. And they said, okay, we've got two big stars, so you can have your woman. And then Melanie Griffith, I mean, she literally owned that film. This is the movie that made her a big star. But, of course, Sigourney Weaver was riding high on Alien. Harrison Ford was riding high on Star Wars and Indiana Jones. I mean, they were huge at the time. So Sigourney Weaver's character, she's all like, oh, you know, us this woman sick together. And so Melanie Griffith, her character Tess, tells her an idea. And Catherine is Sigourney Weaver's character. Catherine's like, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's going to happen. And then she passes off the idea as her own. And what happens is she then goes off on a skiing holiday and breaks her leg and ends up in hospital. So she's out of commission. She's out of the office for a few weeks. And then Melanie Griffith, the Tess, finds out what she's done. And she decides to, in a very subtle, very nice way, get revenge, in that she then pretends to be not a secretary, but actually an executive like Sigourney Weaver. And she takes the idea that she goes to do the pitch that Sigourney Weaver was going to do herself, but then she ended up in hospital with a broken leg. So Melanie goes to do the pitch, and the guy she pitches to is Harrison Ford. Anyway, long convoluted story. The whole thing is, the whole time he doesn't realize she's just a secretary, but she's actually very clever. She is actually studying business at night school. There's also a whole thing about how, you know, she's also, I mean, this is a job in the big city in a huge skyscraper building. There's a view from the office window. You can see it's one of those tall buildings. Sigourney Weaver's character, I mean, she's going skiing in Europe. So it's like, you know, she's a wealthy woman working in New York City. But Melanie Griffith's character, she has to catch the ferry.
Yes.
To work, because she's coming from Staten Island. She doesn't live in the big city. And it's that whole thing. And it was really interesting because I was looking up about it. The guy who wrote the screenplay, he was inspired after going to New York City in 1984, sorry. And he saw loads of women walking through the streets in tennis shoes and carrying their high-heeled shoes.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things I remember from the movie.
Yes.
Because she's walking, running, getting on the ferry, she's in her like white, very, very bright white shoes, tennis shoes. And then when she gets to the office, she takes them off and she puts on her heels. And that's what people did.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe still do. Who knows? Maybe they still do it.
Or I mean, when you're in big cities like London and stuff like that, you do see that. You see everyone's running around in their sneakers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was inspired to write the story. It's a really lovely film. It has such a great ending. It's one of those, yes. You know, the right people get what they deserve and the wrong people and the people, everyone gets what they deserve basically. And it's really cool. And Harrison Ford is really cool. There's also, Alec Baldwin he's got a bit of a smaller role. He plays, this boyfriend who she doesn't end up staying with. But young Alec Baldwin, I have to tell you.
Yeah, we forget.
Young Alec Baldwin, whew.
We do forget because we, you know, we're very much into the more bear hug type of latter day Alec Baldwin. Mm. But young Alec Baldwin, especially because he wouldn't, I mean, he would have, people would have known him there. I mean, what's a Baldwin's fame? But yes, young Alec Baldwin, that's a thirst trap. That's what the kids call it. Thirst trap.
I have to say, hey, and he looks like how William Baldwin looked, because William Baldwin, you know, younger,
yes,
kind of looked more like that.
I see Kevin Spacey's character, Bob Speck, a cokehead arbitrageur. I think I had trouble saying Acapulco just now. A cokehead arbitrageur. Oh, well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's so worth watching. And apart from the glorious hair and makeup, which we will show you, it hasn't dated that much. They actually, there was even in the interview with Sigourney Weaver, they did speak about the outfits, and because it was women trying to compete with men in the working space, they were wearing very subdued business style, you know, like women's business suit type stuff.
Power suits,
very bright colors. Power suits. That's it. Not ridiculous shoulder pads. The clothing that everyone wears could actually still, like, be acceptable today,
but not with the hair and makeup.
The makeup, however, the hair and the makeup just gives the era away, big time. But yeah, and then one last factoid about the movie: it was filmed in various offices around New York, and one of the locations was actually one of the World Trade Center offices.
It would be, yeah,
and in the opening credits, you know, you see the vantage point from the ferry as it's crossing, and you see the Twin Towers, and it's like, you know, one of those things that dates the films that we watch.
It's so weird. So. Even like in the movie poster, you can actually see the Twin Towers in the background. It's quite weird. I know a lot of movies went through, like all the movies went through actually digitally removing it or taking out the posters.
And then one last thing. I mean, Melanie Griffith was known as, you know, having some issues with addiction. It was actually during the filming of this movie that she got into the most trouble with her alcohol and cocaine addiction, where the one time she actually just pitched up on set and she was trashed, like couldn't actually perform for the day. They had to obviously cancel the shoot that day, but then they took the money, like they actually took the money out of her personal thing. And they were like, you have cost us $80,000 by having to cancel today's shoot, and we are taking that out of your money. And it actually embarrassed her so much that it was one of the things that forced her to get clean.
Oh, really?
Was that happening to her? And it was on the set of this movie. And it's so funny because, what did she say? She said it was the late 80s. There was a lot going on party wise in New York. There was a lot of cocaine. There was a lot of temptation. And yeah, that happened. And it was the director, Mike Nichols, who was like, no, you're going to pay. This is how it's going to work. And then it turned out in the end that Mike Nichols was a complete cokehead at the time as well. He just managed it better.
A functional cokehead.
I'm sure the entire cast wasn't for cokeheads at the time.
No doubt. It was the 80s. Just the 80s.
I mean, that scene with Kevin Spacey snorting in the car was probably real. It probably wasn't even fake.
I mean, listen, when you described as a cokehead arbitrageur, then, you know, listen, I'm very glad you reminded me of that movie because it is, it was like a massively culturally relevant movie. That song though, my God, I can't.
No, horrible. We will never play that song in our show.
Like,
never.
So, Dari, it's actually weird. Like you said, I'm doing Halloween movies. I only realized halfway through the month, so I only got a few. My movie's actually also a feminist movie. It's actually been, it's actually been discussed. You know how they say, is Die Hard really a Christmas movie? It's the same as this movie is really a feminist movie. Why they say that is because this movie was actually directed by talking horror, talking a slasher flick. The 80s invented the slasher movie, and this was one of the first ones, and one of the first and most iconic and most culturally relevant was directed by a female director. Okay. Her name is Amy Holden Jones, right? She was the director of this movie. This was her biggest movie that she directed, but she was involved in movies like Mystic Pizza, Beethoven, Indecent Proposal, and The Relic. As well, she's also assistant director on Taxi Driver. So she's got a nice little CV to her name, though I can't say I know much about her. This movie, it wouldn't surprise you to know that it was written. We're going to put the trailer up. It is trash, actually. It was written by lesbian erotica novelist Rita Mae Brown. Okay. You may not know it. I'm going to play you the little bit of the trailer. You heard the little scream coming in earlier. I want to play you just the first little bit of the trailer, and I'm going to just kind of describe to you what goes on.
Okay. The basketball team is planning a party. A slumber party to bare their souls.
So now when they say bare their souls, a girl walks into the shower.
Yeah, bare their breasts.
Bum shot so far, but now we're going into the bare breast part. I don't know if you heard that properly, but she said, I don't know what it is, but my T's are getting bigger. Okay, this is the movie we're into. I'll play a little bit more. This is the Not Safe for Work trailer, right?
All the girls are coming, except Mary and Linda. And they won't be missed. The party begins at 8 o'clock. It's a slumber party for old time's sake.
Love it too. Do you think I'm getting better?
Now, you can hear from that what sort of movie it is. 30 seconds in, there's been three bits of nudity already. Okay.
Your kind of movie.
No, a very 80s kind of movie. The movie is called Slumber Party Massacre. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I haven't, and I definitely haven't seen it.
No, it's been on my radar for a very long time to review it. Not because of the T&A, although that doesn't hurt, but it is the amount of 80s T&A. When I told my wife the movie I'm recommending and I showed her the trailer, she goes, that amount of T&A is so 80s. You did not see that amount of T&A before or since. It was – and we go like – of course it was in movies like Porky's or in slasher movies or in Revenge of the Nerds. It was in every movie. Boobs and bums were in every single movie in the 80s. Okay.
I remember being so shocked. Remember when I spoke about the National Lampoon's movie? Where, I mean, that was a kiddies movie, essentially. It was promoted as a family film. It definitely had parts that should not have been. But I mean, and all of a sudden you're like seeing bare-breasted Beverly D'Angelo, and you're like, what is going on? It was just also completely unnecessary.
No, it was gratuitous.
Like, it was completely unnecessary.
Yeah. No, and exactly that. And it was just for the sake of showing it. I don't know what it was. I do remember watching something about they had relaxed the sort of publication laws, and they were trying to compete. American cinema was losing out to European cinema because they couldn't show bodies and sex scenes and things like that. And then it went completely the other way. And so, but it was just gratuitous for no reason. It was in all sorts of movies, all kinds of movies, no rhyme or reason.
I mean, the scene in National Lampoon, she's literally just in the motel room talking to the husband, and they just showing her getting changed. It's like, it wasn't even like in the context of a sex scene. You know, she was literally just getting changed. She didn't have to be doing that.
No, of course. Now, that's what Slumber Party Massacre is the whole time. If there is an excuse, the slightest excuse to show a nude woman, she will be. Mm-hmm. Now, they're supposed to be high school girls. They look like middle-aged divorcees, okay? All respect to everyone I've just mentioned. None of them look like a high school girl, body-wise nor face-wise. Mm-hmm. These girls have lived. They all wear –
I mean, I'm looking at the cast.
Yes.
I don't recognize any of these names.
So let me tell you a funny thing about the cast. None of them – only one of them has a Wikipedia profile, and unfortunately it's to talk about her suicide. None of the cast did anything. I did a Google search, and I was typing who in the cast went on to suggestion do porn. Okay. I'm not joking. Okay, right.
Probably, hey? Probably. So yeah.
I didn't get any search results, but the fact that it is there knows people have definitely, there is no smoke without fire in the algorithm. Mm-hmm. So listen, it is what it is. It's a bunch of girls. They're home alone. Serial killer comes, wants to kill them. He's got a drill. The drill is a metaphor for you can guess what. And then of course the drill meets a very appropriate end. Hence people having the conversations that this movie is, a feminist movie because of being directed all female cast, a lot of females on the crew, and then obviously written by a lesbian erotica novelist. Mm. Which is just so wild. It set up actually set the genre for the slasher flick, right? So even though, yeah, you know, it did. All slasher flicks then followed this and were set up by that. The director of it, she didn't like the nude scenes. She shot them very paint by numbers. She was like, oh, I got this movie. I got this chance. I have to shoot the nude scenes. But she shot them very paint by numbers and not erotic or titillating at all. It was all just very like mechanical.
Mm.
It had loads of sequels. It spawned a remake. But like I said, it set up the genre. What was so interesting about it is that until Scream, horror movies took themselves very seriously. And since Scream, they take themselves very seriously. But Scream was almost this parody. And Slumber Party Massacre was kind of that. It was parodying something that it was actually creating, which was quite wild. It's like I said, it's gone on to become a cult classic. Any factoids that I can throw at you here is, what can I say to you? No, I think I've given you everything. Why should I trivialize it?
I have to say, I mean, I'm intrigued, and if my husband hasn't seen it, which would be unlikely, he probably has, I'm sure he would enjoy it. So, you know, I might just try and check it out.
Do check it out. I'm not going to put the Not Safe for Work trailer because, I mean, we just got our page back onto Facebook for posting illegal content. So I don't want to go back there. I will post it up. The movie poster is beautiful. It is like genre defining slasher movie poster.
Well, that you can post up, I'm sure.
That I can post up. You can see nips. There are definitely nips that you can see in there. So I don't know if how Zuck's feeling.
Maybe it's too risque.
Risky and risque. The score, the entire score was recorded on a small Casio synthesizer, which I quite like that. And when you do listen to it, you will definitely get the sense that this is done. But that's my movie.
Which would still be much better to listen to than Carly Simon's song.
Good point. Good point. Great running gag. Nice tying it all together. Slumber Party Massacre. It is actually a feminist movie, a staple of feminist cinema from me. What a grown up I am. And Working Girl.
Thank you, Paolo.
Working Girl, Dori.
Yeah.
You know,
that really is a grown-up film.
We're doing all the things you and I. Listen, I'm going to complain about Greta Thunberg after Wham Corner. Strap in.
Okay.
I'm not happy.
Okay.
This is That 80s Show. Dori was very cryptic this week. She sends a WhatsApp, says, "Watch this. I've got a great story." I watch it. I said, "Okay, I've watched it." She says, "Cool. I'm not telling you the story. We're saving it for the show." Cryptic.
Well, I mean, obviously.
Of course.
Paolo, you know, I think you did listen to it. There was a great podcast series that came out recently called Wind of Change.
Right. Yeah.
Which was actually a whole thing about how the Scorpion song, Winds of Change, was actually written by the CIA.
Right. Yes.
To, in a way to kind of resolve the Cold War. And it was a very interesting podcast series where they delved into the whole like Russian 80s music scene. And in the end, they didn't really come up with any significant proof that it had been, that there was CIA involvement in the song, but it was a fascinating series to listen to. Now, I don't know if you know that since then, there have been a couple of bonus episodes released on that podcast, but only on Spotify.
Okay.
And I happened upon one recently. I was like, oh, let me listen to this. It blew my mind. It was an interview with a woman named Joanna Stingray. Not her real name, funnily enough.
Sure, okay.
Her real name was Joanna Fields, but she became known as Joanna Stingray. And in the actual context of the episode, they tracked her down. She was an American woman, a woman from California, who got very involved with the Russian music scene in the 80s. And they tracked her down because they wanted to interview her for the podcast series. And they ended up, they thought they'd get like an hour, maybe an hour and a half with her. They ended up talking to her for 7 hours. Joanna Stingray, first of all, she definitely, okay, so the video that I sent you was a song that she had recorded in her own right as a, and I'm putting it in inverted commas, singer, because, I mean, you can attest, Paolo, not a great song at all.
No, it's terrible. It's a terrible song.
Terrible, really terrible. She cannot sing, but she clearly was quite connected. She was in California and she did become like this famous icon, I mean, to the point where at the beginning and the end of this music video, the very famous Andy Warhol actually does this little piece, which is really obscure and really funny. I mean, I love Andy Warhol. And if you don't know too much about him, he was just weird. And he liked her and she said to him, will you just do this thing for my music video? And he seemed to not know what he was doing at all, but it was really kind of funny. And I think that she clearly had, the song is called Beverly Hills Brat. And I think that is actually very accurate, that she was this kind of spoiled brat from Beverly Hills.
I was so confused because wasn't there an 80s movie called Beverly Hills Brat?
Oh, there's so many things. If you type Beverly Hills Brat into Google, you're going to find so many things. But in 1983, she made this song and was one of the earlier references to that phrase. But in the podcast, what they tell, which you don't see on any of the things on YouTube, is that her and her sister were raised by a very conservative, their father was very conservative, you must remember, this was the Cold War, early 80s, and they were told, oh, Russia, it's evil. Russians are evil, and it's this terrible thing, and America is great, and Russia is terrible. And when she got old enough, her and her sister both were like, you know what? Maybe dad is wrong. Let's go and check it out for ourselves. And they traveled to Russia, the two of them, on a holiday, literally, to check it out. While there, she met up with these guys who were kind of underground rock artists in Russia because, I mean, it wasn't that the music was banned,
this is a bizarre story. You know. This is so bizarre.
No, you haven't even heard the best part. I'm still coming. In fact, we might have just split the story into two parts because it's a bit of a long one, but I want to get to the best part. In fact, so I'm not going to give too much away because we'll put up the YouTube thing that tells the story. But in a nutshell, she gets friendly with these guys who are all involved in this like underground rock scene. And it's quite funny because the KGB, they were keeping an eye on them. It wasn't that they were banning them or not allowing them to perform. They were keeping an eye on them because they thought, oh, this is a way that we can see what the young people are up to, kind of thing. So they let them do their thing. She got very involved with these bands who were kind of punk and rock and that kind of thing. And she ended up being responsible for a lot of the Russian music actually getting out of Russia in the 80s because she would take the recordings back to America with her. And she actually like managed to like record like a compilation of Russian music. Through this happening, David Bowie heard it, got in touch with her and was like, oh, you know, I really want to support these guys. I'm going to give you a guitar. When you next go to Russia, take this guitar to them as a gift. Now, of course, the guys in Russia knew exactly who David Bowie was. She goes over with this guitar. She gets stopped in the airport at customs. They're like, you can't bring this in. What is this? She's like, no, it's mine. It's mine. And I have to travel with it because, you know, I'm a musician. And they let her through, but they wrote a very strict document saying that she needs to be leaving with this exact thing because they basically didn't want her to be giving it to Russia, this guitar.
Right.
So they made a note that when she leaves, she has to have this guitar with her. She was like, damn, I wanted to give this as a gift to these musos. Anyway, so she thought, okay, I'll figure something out. So she's there. By the way, she got so involved in the scene, she ended up marrying one of the Russian musicians. But then she didn't move to Russia. So they got married, but they had this long distance relationship for years and years and years. And then eventually she did go and she stayed there for a while. And then the marriage didn't last. They ended up getting divorced. But so while she's there, she's thinking, oh, what am I going to do about this guitar? And she felt so bad. And she eventually said to them, when she was leaving, she's like, guys, I have to take the guitar back. And they were like, no, you don't. And they come, one of the guys had made a replica of the guitar. They'd literally made like a decent enough replica that it passed through, that she got away with taking this replica back because they wanted the guitar from David Bowie, obviously. It was such a great story. And I just have to tell you a couple of things because I actually obviously, of course, delved into this rabbit hole, which is really amazing. And like I say, she released this. It was actually called Red Wave 4 and Red Wave, four underground bands from the Soviet Union. And she made this album in the '80s in America. And then that's how Andy Warhol and David Bowie and everyone like got wind of it.
Right.
And then it says, yeah, on Wikipedia, the Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, also got to know about it. Surprised that this music was published by a foreign company, he instructed the Minister of Culture to ease the publication of music of young Soviet musicians inside the country.
So
she literally changed. She changed, like she made political change, this woman. It's quite amazing. And she married this guy. And it's so funny because now it is, if you look at her on the documentary that's on YouTube, she's in her 60s. She looks amazing. She looks way better than she did in that 1983 music video. Way better. And it says as of 2004, Stingray was the executive director of the Beverly Hills High School Alumni Association and working part-time as a real estate agent.
This
woman had the most amazing life, and now she's a real estate agent.
Now she's going to sell you like a condominium.
But what a fascinating story. And like, it just, you know, I love, because we always focus on like, you know, America and the UK in terms of music. Once in a while, we'll do our Euro trash and that kind of stuff. You know, you enjoy Tala Disco, but we really haven't delved into the Russian music scene from the '80s. And this was a window into it for me.
Dari, what a strange thing you actually mentioned there, because I had a story lined up that I was trying to find space for about the Yugoslavian music industry in the '80s. So maybe next week we pick up with a bit more detail, because it's
cool.
Equally as bonkers. So you're quite right. I mean, it's like everyone is, they weren't just making 80s music. To them, it was just music. It just happened to be in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly.
What a bonkers, bonkers story. And here I was thinking it was like a song from, you know, a movie that I'd forgotten.
Exactly. So cool. But yeah, I'll put all those links up and definitely check out that little docy. Because it's so Russian. There's a scene, because obviously it's filmed like, you know, home movie style, of these guys rehearsing in their lounge. And I mean, the one guy standing there in literally just a black Speedo, drumming a black Speedo. It's like so Russian.
So Russian, so 80s. Listen, catch that whole story. It's a lot to digest. I mean, I had to like sit there taking notes on that. So listen back to this on the podcast and get all those details, and obviously go along with the companion links. This is That 80 Show. You can find the podcast on Cliff Central, as well as just look for us on That 80 Show SA on Facebook. I want to close off with, look, I know it's not a good look for like middle-aged white men to be angry at Greta Thunberg, right? And I don't want to be that guy. And she can do what it wants. Mm-hmm. And I'm neither here nor there. We don't really have an opinion on Greta Thunberg until Greta Thunberg. You can say a lot of things. You can accuse our generation of doing a lot of things. That's fine. Knock yourself out. She went too far. She went too goddamn far. This does have Rick Astley's approval, but I don't know if it has mine. Greta Thunberg was at a climate conference, and I can play you the audio, but you have to find this. We're going to put the video on That 80 Show SA Facebook. What it feels like is when we were in high school, we knew the like uncool kids were having parties, and this is what was happening at those parties. Okay, they were very in themselves. This is from TikTok. Take a listen. This is Rick Astley's TikTok. The characters, the obviously is Greta Thunberg and some other guy dressed like a minion doing the most worst things. Take a listen.
We are no strangers to love.
You know the rules, and so do I.
There is terrible dancing happening now. I must tell you, they're trying to do Rick Astley's dance from Never Gonna Give You Up. But in a way that young people shouldn't be that rhythmically challenged.
Okay.
And now they're singing it. This is Greta Thunberg and a minion friend. This is so shit. I can't even handle it anymore. They have the lyrics written on a piece of paper. I really hope they're environmentally friendly about that paper, that it's, you know, gets recycled. They don't throw it away. This is such a nightmare of a thing. They're still going.
How dare they? Paolo, how dare they use paper? How dare they?
How dare they use the song? They're still going. They're still going in this. It's still playing here. It's a minute and a half of Greta Thunberg. Let's tap back in there. Now they run off stage. I don't know what that is. She's drunk on power.
I understand why you're upset, but at the same time, I'm quite happy to see young people loving Rick Astley so much. I mean, that's pretty cool.
No, this is no love. They're disrespecting the whole thing. This is disrespect. You got to watch this video. You got it. This is disrespectful.
Okay. I'll watch the video. Look, I'm sure it's going to make me angry.
Rick, it will make you angry because we're middle-aged people. And Greta Thunberg triggers us. I don't know why she makes us angry. Rick Astley endorses it, right? Even endorsed it like with a post in what nationality is Greta Thunberg? She's Finnish.
Swedish. Scandinavian?
Swedish. She's Scandinavian. She's Swedish. So he obviously includes some Swedish in there. This is triggering. I'm not very happy about Greta Thunberg. This steps over the line. This is too much. This is where I go, you know, Greta, I get it. I get why you're so disliked. How dare you defile Rick Astley? Guess what I'm doing? Guess what I'm doing? Not watching my carbon footprint. Learn you. Show you, Greta. So this has been That 80 Show. Anything, like we said, we spoke about on That 80 Show essay on Facebook or the podcast on cliffcentral.com. Look for the best logo I think I've seen outside of the 80s. It is so phenomenal. Dori, I like to close off with a lesson of the day. What did you learn in today's show?
I learned that in an alternative universe, you and I will be doing much the same thing.
Yes. Thanks for joining me, Dori. Goodbye.
Bye.